One year during college, I came home for Christmas over the break and had a great Christmas time with our families. And we got past the Christmas Day thing and into the next couple of days. And somewhere in there, next couple of days after that Christmas, my sister and I needed to return a gift that wasn't the right size or something. I don't know, the right color or something. So we were driving together, my sister driving. I was in the passenger seat in the front, and we were having a great conversation. We were on our way to Target. So we got to Target, and we found a parking place, and we're having this conversation, and my sister pulls in, puts it in park. We open the doors, and I'm climbing out over on the passenger side, and I you just kind of turn your back to the door in the car, and I took it with my left hand. I swung it kind of shut and continued the conversation with my sister, who's getting out on her side, and I'm walking toward the back of the car, and I went kind of this tug, oh, and I thought, you just kind of had that kind of numbs sensation. And you think, what in the world? And I look back and I realize I have shut my middle finger in the car door. I mean, completely closed. Not a jar, not a little gap. It was closed and locked. And I stood there kind of looking, going, now isn't that odd? And you kind of have a numb thing, but then very quickly you start to realize this hurts. Well, by then, my sister has come around, and she's back by the trunk. And she sees what's happening. I said, very nicely, may I add, unlock the car. So my sister doesn't come to my door with the key and unlock it. She goes back around the car, over to her side, finds the key, unlocks the door, sets down in, starts to slide over. And by this point, I'm mustering everything within myself. And I'm waiting, and I'm in a little bit of a hurry. And so she goes to pull up the lock on the inside, and I pull up on the outside, and it jams a lock, of course. So I'm starting to get a little more panicky, and we do this kind of this strange little rhythmic thing where she's pulling up, and I'm pulling up, and we're doing this, and jamming the lock every time. And finally, my sister's face is looking up out the window at me, and I go, open the door! And she rolls down the window and hands me the keys. A ball the size of a softball, about 45 keys on 6 different chains all together there. And it's bouncing up in my hand. I'm thinking, pretty soon the right one's coming around and I'll grab it. I'm just kind of bouncing there. And I'm like, well, this man's walking by. And he sees what's happening. And he runs over and he grabs the keys out of my hand. And I think, what chance is it you're going to be able to find the right key? And my sister somehow pointed out quickly, and he inserted the key, and he unlocked. I pulled up, and immediately took my hand, applied pressure, put it between my knees, and hopped all the way across the parking lot as fast as I could go. To which the man responded by running after me, going, let me see it! And I thought, are you out of your mind? I'm not even going to look at this thing. You know that feeling? A feeling like you wonder, will it fall on the ground if I take the pressure? Will it be dangling by a string? Is it even still there? But you know it hurts, but you just can't bring yourself to pry your fingers loose and look. You know that feeling? What's it like when you do that, not to a physical wound, but to an internal one? A wound in the immaterial part of you that hurts so badly. All you want to do is wrap it up, cover it up, shove it back down inside, and never, ever really have to look at it anymore. Oh, it hurts, but you just can't bring yourself to examine. What do you do then? Well, I want to invite you to do a very distasteful thing this morning. I want you to join me in prying back the fingers of Job as he is clutching his wound. We've been studying now in the book of Job for several weeks. We've heard or read the drama of the calamity that came upon him. Loss of family, loss of wealth, loss of social standing, loss of personal health, loss of everything. In cataclysmic, dramatic moment, everything gone. We've heard his friends, one by one by one, come and counsel him. But we haven't heard Job speak yet. And so this morning I want you to come with me to the book of Job and let's hear what Job says as he responds to these friends and their counsel and to God out of that pain. to kind of pry back the fingers and look at the wound and see what it is we find there. And I invite you to do that, because when we listen to Job's cries, we hear an echo of our own struggles with suffering. And so it's not just prying the fingers off of Job's wound. It really, in many ways, is daring to look again at some wound of your spirit that you've buried deep and dark, somewhere where you never, ever want to see it again. Well, I want you to begin with me by thinking about the perspectives of a wounded soul. You know, you introduce pain into the human experience and perspectives get all distorted, don't they? I mean, you've heard the expression blinding pain. And it's given for a reason, because there's a physical pain so deep that you can't see anything, or what you do see is all distorted because the pain is just so overwhelming. Was the pain in the spirit like that? That distorts and confuses and morphs reality in our vision and understanding of things. That can happen in our perspectives on self. We look at ourselves through the lenses of pain and we don't see what's really there, but we see things that seem like they're really there. You look at yourself through pain, you might end up like Job saying, "I'm a joke." And you indulge yourself in a little self-depreciation. As he does in Job 12:4, when he says, "I am a joke to my friends. The one who called on God and He answered him, the just and blameless man, is a joke." Maybe that's how you feel in your pain. Or maybe you're like Job and you say, "I want to die." In Job 6:8 and 9, he says, "Why won't God give me what I ask? Why won't He answer my prayer? If only He would go ahead and kill me. If I knew He would, I would leap for joy no matter how great my pain." Could be you're there right now. Maybe you know somebody like that. In Job 7:15, he said, "I would rather die and be strangled than to live in this miserable body." Or maybe you're like Job and you have kind of this pendulum swing of perspective, this almost schizophrenic view of yourself, and you're depreciating yourself and you're wanting to die. And then the next moment you say, I'm okay. Yeah, you enter into a little self-justification. In Job 31:5, he says, "I swear that I have never acted wickedly and never tried to deceive others. Let God weigh me on honest scales and He will see how innocent I am." I'm okay. Or maybe you end up like Job thinking, you know, "I'm all that matters." And it's just self-absorption. And we see this especially in chapter 28, 29, 30, and 31, because those four chapters are Job's final statements, his final response to this round of counseling he gets from his friends. And in those four chapters, he uses the personal pronouns I, me, or my 198 times. Pain makes you pretty absorbed with yourself. But it's not just your perspectives on yourself that change with pain's entrance, it's also your perspectives on others. You look at them and you say, "They fail me. They fail me." In Job 6:14, he said, "In trouble like this, I need loyal friends, whether I've forsaken God or not. But you, my friends, you deceive me like streams that go dry when no rain comes. You fail me." Or maybe say, "They persecute me." Job 19:22, "Why must you persecute me the way God does? Haven't you tormented me long enough?" Or they don't identify with me. Job 16, verse 4. "Are you going to keep on talking forever? Do you always have to have the last word? If you were in my place and I in yours, I could say everything that you're saying. I could shake my head wisely and drown you with a flood of words." Or perhaps like Job, say, "They don't help me. They do not help me." Job 13:40 says, "You cover up your ignorance with lies. You are like doctors who can't heal anyone." You see, when you take a painful experience and it comes into the human life, you begin to see yourself, you begin to see others as they are not really, but it seems they are, and you are. Maybe you've heard the story of the woman who was traveling via airplane. She was going from somewhere to somewhere, I don't know where, but she was in the middle of that trek, and she had come to an airport where she had a long layover of several hours. She wasn't very happy about it, but she made the stop, and she thought, oh, I'm going to make the best of this. And so she got off of the one plane. She went to the direction of where her next plane would be taken off, and on the way she saw one of those little stores in the airports, and she went in, she bought a newspaper, and she saw a bag of cookies, and she grabbed a bag of cookies, she paid for it, and she got her things together, and she marched off and found a spot where all the chairs are lined up in a big row, and she sat down, and she got comfortable, and she snapped open her paper, and she started to read. And then as she's reading, there's kind of this sound entered her conscious thoughts, amidst all the other sounds, and it sounded like cellophane crinkling or something. And she looks down next to her, and this man has his hand in the bag of cookies, taking a cookie. And she thinks, oh, the nerve! Unbelievable. So he takes it, and she just promptly sticks her hands in and takes one of the cookies and nibbles at it for a little while. And she hears the crinkling again, and she looks out. She can see out of the corner of her eye. He's in the bag of cookies. And she says, good grief. And so this goes on for some time, until it gets right down to the very end, and they kind of been going backward. And all of a sudden, the guy reaches in. You can tell he's fishing around. He grabs the last cookie, breaks it in half, lays it on top of the bag, and then smiles at her and nibbles away on his part. And she's just beside herself. And she takes that cookie, and she looks at him with a glare, and she eats it. Goes back to her paper. And then in a little while, she hears her flight called and realizes the man has gone on, and she gathers her things up. She grabs her paper, folds it up, and she grabs her bag and goes to put the paper in it and sees her bag of unopened cookies. And she realizes, neither that man nor I myself am exactly what I was thinking we were just a few moments ago. Well, that happens, in the life full of pain, you begin to see others, you begin to see yourself differently than we really are. But most sad of all is the fact that we lose our perspective on God. Maybe like Job, you think God is unjust. Job 10:3, he says, is it right for you to be so cruel, to despise what you yourself have made, and then smile on the schemes of wicked people? God, you're unjust. Or maybe you think God is silent. He's just this far distant deity who doesn't really care and doesn't really have any interaction with his creation. Job 31:35. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Behold, here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Maybe to determine that God is not good. Job says in Job 7:20, are you harmed by my sin, you jailer? Why use me for your target practice? Am I so great a burden to you? Or maybe you think God is your enemy. Job said in chapter 16, verse 7, you have worn me out, God. You have let my family be killed. You have seized me. You are my enemy. And maybe on that pendulum swing of up and down, back and forth, here and there, schizophrenic kind of view of reality in yourself, you come to think God is great. Somewhere in there, you run to these things that God is just so great and vast and awesome and exalted. Look at chapter 26 of Job. And listen in as Job describes who God is. Job 26, beginning in verse 7. It says, he spreads out the northern skies over empty space. He suspends the earth over nothing. He wraps up the waters in his clouds, yet the clouds do not burst under their weight. He covers the face of the full moon, spreading his clouds over it. He marks out the horizon on the face of the waters for a boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of the heavens quake aghast at his rebuke. By his power he churned up the sea. By his wisdom he cut Rahab to pieces. By his breath the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. Now look, verse 14. And these are but the outer fringe of his works. How faint the whisper we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of His power? See, these perspectives on God are not the reasoned thoughts of a theologian. They are the scrambled distortions of one groping, desperately trying to find God in the midst of the pain. C.S. Lewis is a man who lived most of his life as a bachelor, very contented and happy, but later in life met a wonderful woman, fell in love, they were married and had a wonderful, though very brief, marriage, where she was soon taken through cancer. And out of that pain that he never could have imagined himself experiencing, he wrote a book called A Grief Observed. And he talks about how when we address God or we address others, we often speak to them, not as they really are, but as we kind of imagine them to be, out of the filter of our pain. And Lewis wrote in that book, "In real life, God's words and acts are, if we observe closely, hardly ever quite, quote, in character. That is, in what we call His character. There always is a card in His hand that we didn't know about. Somehow it seems God's not being God. Or at least the God we thought He was." You know what a caricature is, right? I mean, it's one of those depictions where it's close enough to reality that you realize who it's supposed to be, but it's so distorted as to be either grotesque or cartoonish, to make a point. You know, we think of political cartoons, and you know, Richard Nixon always had the big long ski nose, and Bill Clinton had hair the size of New Jersey and a big bulbous nose, you know, and they just distort. But I'm saying to you that that's what pain does to us. We begin to look at God as like some caricature, or we look at ourselves, or we look at others that way. And out of the pain, we don't see what really is. And we need to realize that. And cry out to God to help us come back to seeing and hearing what really is. Again. And to bring our perspectives into line with reality. Now, realizing our perspectives get skewed, let's think about the responses of a wounded soul. Think about some unhelpful responses to suffering. In other words, what did Job do wrong? Now, Job wasn't suffering because he had sinned, but what we need to know is, in his suffering, did Job sin? And there's some things that he did that were less than helpful, and they're often seen in people who experience pain, and they're unhelpful to them as well. One of those would be argue with God. That tends not to be a great option, at least not a very successful one. In Job chapter 13, verse 3, Job said, "My dispute is with God, not you," referring to his friends. "I want to argue my case with Him. I've lost all hopes. So what if God kills me? I'm going to state my case to Him." Maybe you're mad at God. You argue with. Or you justify self, which is in fact a backhanded way of condemning God. And it's really, justifying self is really the opposite of praise, because instead of exalting God for who He is and recognizing and affirming in faith who He is in all of His greatness and glory, we are caught up with ourselves, looking at our own problems, examining all the angles, and building a case on our behalf. Hardening your heart is another response sometimes that isn't terribly helpful. You know the old saying that says, you know, the same sun that melts the butter hardens the clay. Well, we have to ask ourselves, what is pain doing to my heart toward God and toward others? You know, we have, at the end of the book of Genesis in the Old Testament, we have this beautiful picture of Joseph who was wronged by his brothers and suffered terribly for many years, taken in the land of Egypt. But there God blessed him. And eventually when he was in power and his brothers were brought before him, what did he say to them? "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." In other words, he'd come to the place in his pain where he could say, "Look, I can see now that even though it was a very painful path to walk..." But you go just a page or two more into the book of Exodus, and what do you find? You find Pharaoh.
in the land of Egypt, facing plague after plague after plague upon his land and upon his people. And what does it say over and over and over and over and over and over again in the book of Exodus? Pharaoh hardened his heart, and Pharaoh hardened his heart, and Pharaoh hardened his heart, and Pharaoh hardened his heart. Repeatedly. More and more resistant against God. Stiffened his spine, stood his ground, and would not go with God. Now, we can do either one in pain. But just realize, hardening your heart toward God is not terribly helpful. And maybe lose hope is another one. Job 7:7, he said, "My eye will not again see good." Tim Hansel said that adversity can either destroy or build us up depending on our chosen response. Our chosen response. It can either build us up or destroy us depending on our chosen response. And you don't agree? I invite you to spend some time in a nursing home and talk with the people. And you will meet some folks and you'll hear their stories and you will be left amazed by the pain and the suffering and the difficulties that some of those folks have faced and the sweetness of their character and countenance and life and the grace that they exude. And you say, how could someone come out of that and be so gracious? And you'll turn to the very next person, you'll hear very similar stories, and you'll hear a bitter, angry, vindictive person. How do we choose to respond? Well, there's some unhelpful ways. But I want you to think about some helpful responses to suffering. And this is really an examination of some of the things that Job did that were right, that were helpful. Be honest. First of all. And Job was that. If you read through the passages where Job speaks, he was at least honest, if nothing else. I mean, it was what it was, and he named it as he felt it and saw it, and he told God and he told his friends and he told himself all about it. You really see that in the Psalms, too, where David prays. And you know, frankly, you pray through the Psalms, and what I find is it's very easy to quit praying those Psalms and begin to just read them because you don't feel real comfortable saying some of the stuff that gets said in the Psalms to God. Because we're just not that authentic with God. But when the pain starts, you need to be honest with yourself and with God. Authentic. He can handle that. Keep seeking God. Keep seeking Him. Over in chapter 23, in verse 5, or excuse me, chapter 23, verse 3, if you want to look there, he says, "If only I knew where to find Him, if only I could go to His dwelling, I would state my case before Him, fill my mouth with arguments, I would find out what He would answer me and consider what He has to say." Now, his attitude may not have been right. He may want to have an argument, but at least he kept saying, "I am not going to let go of this. I am going to seek God. I will have an audience with God. I will seek Him." And you have to commit to doing that. Because it's very easy when the pain comes and you, at least in some fashion, think that God's responsible for that, it's very easy not to keep seeking Him. It's very easy to drift away from the spiritual disciplines that you've been exercising in terms of being in His Word, reading it, studying it, applying it, memorizing, meditating on it. It's very easy to drift away from prayer, the fellowship of the body of Christ, and just to kind of go off your own way. You have to keep seeking God. Thirdly, look to God's mediator. Say, what in the world does that mean? Well, look over at chapter 9. And begin at verse 29. And look what Job is longing for. He says, verse 29, chapter 9, "Since I am already found guilty, why should I struggle in vain? Even if I washed myself with soap and my hands with washing soda, You would plunge me into a slime pit so that even my clothes would detest me." Now listen, verse 32. "He is not a man," that is, God, "is not a man like me that I might answer Him. that we might confront each other in court. If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, to lay His hand upon us both. Someone to remove God's rod from me so that His terror would frighten me no more. Then I would speak up without fear of Him. But as it is now, as now it stands with me, I cannot. He's saying, if only God would provide some mediator between Him and me so that in this pain, where He seems so distant, so silent, I could communicate with Him. Then I would be able to process and deal with this pain. But as it is now, there is no one to stand between God and me. Now, what was Job hoping for? A mediator. Who was Job hoping for? He didn't have a name for Him, but His name is Jesus Christ. And we, this side of the cross, know Him as the one mediator between man, God and man. The man Christ Jesus, as Paul wrote it in the New Testament. That God Himself sent His Son, God in human flesh, to stand between God and man as a mediator. As is pictured in these communion elements, He in His own body took the sin that distanced us from God. And that sin that Job was talking about, He couldn't possibly expunge Himself from Himself. Jesus Christ took that upon Himself. He bore the penalty for it. He satisfied the wrath of God against our sin in the person of His Son Jesus. And then He raised Him from the dead, so that now through Christ we have a mediator to God. And we can have relationship with Him. And not just that He's removed our sin from creating this barrier between God and us, but that God, as God in human flesh, He experienced what we experience. And He understands, not as a far distant deity, the hardships and sufferings of this life, but as one who God in human flesh experienced all of these things, He comes and He understands us, as Hebrews says, as a compassionate and faithful high priest at the right hand of God right now, praying to God the Father for you. In your pain, He's speaking to the Father on your behalf right now because He understands your pain. That's what Job longed for. And that's what God provided. And that's what you can have in Christ. Then we would be wise if we committed ourselves to trust to the end. Trust to the end. You don't understand God. You don't understand His ways. He allows things. He seems to do things that don't make sense to you. Trust to the end. Job said in Job 13:15, though He slay me, I will hope in Him. C.S. Lewis said, in the midst of his pain, I thought I trusted the rope until it mattered to me whether it would bear me. Now it matters and I find it didn't. This faith, this God, didn't hold me. Hold in juxtaposition to that, the statement made by Reverend Sammy Dagger when we began this series and we watched that video clip, remember, from a brother from the land of Lebanon, full of war, place where he recounts the martyrdom of dear brothers and sisters in Christ, lived out his whole Christian life and experience in ministry in a land of hardship and pain. And he said, though He crush me, I will trust Him. He is my God. I love Him. We need to go with Samuel. I will trust Him to the end. And finally, let eternity give perspective. Let eternity give some perspective. Look at chapter 19 and those verses that were read just a little bit ago for us. In verse 25, Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end, He will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. In Job 23, he said, He knows the way I take, and when He has tried me, I will come forth as gold. He was looking past the pain. Yes, through the pain, but past the pain, past this life, to that which matters forever, which is anchored in the person and character of our Redeemer. And saying, I'm measuring what I'm experiencing now from that fixed point back, not from my experience, my shifting emotions and pain forward to what I think might be true based on what I'm experiencing. Let eternity give perspective. So I ask you, what is your response right now to the pain, the wound in your spirit, that immaterial part of you? Are there parts of you, experiences you have had, things that have been done to you that you have wrapped up and you have applied pressure and you have hidden it away and you have stuffed it down inside and you know that it hurts, you know that it affects everything, but you just can't bring yourself to look at it? You need to pry your fingers off of that. Do it before God. Do it with God's help. Do it with a trusted friend who will walk with you. But you need to bring that wound open in the presence of God, where He can apply the healing balm of grace and truth. When I was just a little tiny kid, very, very small kid, I remember this one of the earliest memories I think I have from childhood. It was probably Saturday night, so it was bath night or something, and so I was needing to take my bath, and my mother had gone in this old farmhouse we lived in. We had one of those big white tubs with claw feet, and she turned on the water to run my bath water, and it had one of those, those rubber flexible hoses with like a shower thing at the end that you put on the end of the faucet. That was laying in there, and she didn't take that up, just was running out through there, and she was filling up. So, I mess around, fiddling around. Finally, the tub's filling up, and I climb in, and I'm sitting there, and I don't know, I was messing around, fiddling with stuff, and, I probably was messing with the hot and cold and everything. Well, anyway, I'm sitting there, and this hose thing is down in the water, and it's filling up, and of course, I'm trying to get it as high as I possibly can before my mother will turn it off. Well, in the midst of that, just before she was going to come turn it off, I reached down, I picked up that hose, and I pulled it up facing me, and I instantly got blasted in face and chest with scalding hot water. And I screamed and, went berserk and was bawling and crying, and I don't know, my mother fished me out of there, I'm sure, and turned off the water and all that and everything. But what I remember, and my mom remembers vividly to this day, and will not let me forget about, is sitting on her lap there, crying and crying and crying and crying, then all of a sudden stopping. I look it up into her face and saying, "Why did you do that?" You talk about creating a wound in your mother's heart. She didn't do that. But sometimes we seem to look up into the face of God and we say, "Why did you do that, God? Why would you do that to me?" Well, out of those distorted perspectives and sometimes our unhelpful responses, I think it's helpful to go back to that simple few lines of wisdom from C.H. Spurgeon, who said, "God is too kind, too good to be unkind. He is too wise to be mistaken. And when you cannot trace His hand, you can always trust His heart." Is that what you're doing? The wound open before God, the two of you together examining it, letting Him bring balm of healing grace to it, you trusting Him, even when not understanding Him, you're trusting Him. I pray it is so. Let's bow before Him right now and spend just some moments in quietness. It's perhaps during these moments you would pry your fingers off of that wound and expose it again to God, to see it for what it is. Tell Him, "Lord, I just need to be authentic and real with You. I need to be honest." And just silence, quietness there. Speak to Him about what it is that frightens you so to look at and examine. Ask Him to begin to help you pull those fingers off. Stop the cover up. Ask Him to help you trust Him.